Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Journalist Nazila Fathi grew up in Iran, and her childhood was shaped by the country's dramatic transformation. She was just 9 years old when the 1979 Islamic Revolution began. That's when the Shah of Iran, who was supported by the U.S., was overthrown, and the Islamic Republic, led by Ayatollah Khomeini, took charge.
Nazila writes in her new book that the revolution changed every aspect of her life. She could no longer choose what clothes to wear, what sentiments she could utter in public, and what actions could wind up getting her family thrown into prison. After all, her friend's father was executed for speaking out against the new regime.
She writes, "The revolution took away Iranians' personal liberties, but it also gave many people a taste of power and opportunity that had long been denied to them."
Against that chaotic backdrop, Fathi became the New York Times' sole Iranian correspondent. But nearly 6 years ago, threats that she got from the Iranian government forced her to flee Iran.
Now she's written a book about her life in turbulent Iran. It's called The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. Nazila Fathi is a former associate at Harvard's Belfer Center at the Kennedy School of Government and a fellow at the Shorenstein Center and at the Nieman Foundation at Harvard.
She's going to be speaking about The Lonely War, her book, tonight at the Harvard Bookstore in Harvard Square. Right now, though, she joins us live in the studio here in Boston. Welcome, Nazila.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you.
Nice to have you here. And listeners, we'd like to hear from you as well. What questions do you have for Nazila about growing up in Iran and growing up during the revolution, or maybe about her life here in the U.S. as this country wrestles diplomatically with Iran right now, or maybe about reporting in a country where doing so can cost you your life? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Nazila, you have some really nice, vivid touchstones in your life. And these, in some ways, parallel the development of the 1979 revolution in Iran. We mentioned you were 9 years old when the revolution happened. You talk about things such as your favorite place of all when you were 9 years old, and that is the local swimming pool. And the fun that you had there, even what you wore there, changed radically as you were growing up and the revolution was taking hold. Can you describe some of that for us?
Yeah. I mean, as you said, I was just 9 years old, and there were certain things that had a certain meaning for me. And one of those things was the swimming pool that we had in the housing complex where I was growing up. It was a place where we swam in the summers, in the wintertime when it snowed. We went into the pool and sort of rode our slides there. Our life was centered around that pool. And when I was 9 years old after the revolution, the revolutionaries banned girls from swimming in the pool. And instead, we had to sit there and watch the boys swim.
So you could go, but you couldn't wear bathing suits and you couldn't go in the water.
We couldn't even go close to the pool. We had to sit outside the pool. The pool was surrounded by a fence, by a metal fence, so we could see the boys. But we couldn't go through the gates and be closer to the pool. And instead, we had to sit behind the fence in a thick coat and headscarf and watch the boys dive into the pool and enjoy the water. I mean, they could also swim only until the age of 15 or 16, until they reached puberty.
And then what?
And then they were banned from swimming, too.
How did you understand what was happening? Your parents did not support the Iranian revolution. What did they tell you about going along? Because you had to go along.
There was no other way. After Khomeini returned, if anyone...
This is the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Ayatollah Khomeini returned in February 1979. Within a few days after his return, he started rounding up anyone who was opposed to his regime and executed them. And this was a very serious thing. We learned very quickly that we had to lie. to protect ourselves and our families. I had a friend whose family was Baha'i, and the revolutionaries denounced the religion. They started arresting people, and my father's friend was executed within months after the revolution. So very quickly I learned that if I wanted to stay safe, I wanted my parents to be safe, and my parents had never supported the revolution or Khomeini, I couldn't talk about those things.
You couldn't talk about them, and your parents, your mother specifically, said to you as you were heading off to school one day, and your younger sister was as well, if they ask you if your parents support the revolution, lie.
Exactly. My mother told us that if we were asked at school whether our parents supported the revolution, we had to say yes. And gradually I learned the other lessons as well. I learned that if they asked us at school whether your parents go to the Friday prayers, I had to say yes. When the war broke out with Iraq, I knew when the school authorities asked us if we had loved ones, cousins, family members who were fighting in the war, I had to say yes, and none of it was true.
At the same time, you had many friends, family friends, people who were in your apartment building who did support the revolution. And in the beginning, it seemed like, you know, when your families would get together, and these are very nice homes that you're in, middle-class homes, as we would picture in many homes here in the United States, when you got together to discuss the politics of the time, in the beginning, it was almost playful. Your father and your friend's father could sort of argue together. But it took a much different tone over time.
It did, but not among people of my sort of my family's class and my family's friends. There was a huge population before the revolution among the middle class and upper middle class who were opposed to the Shah. They wanted to see the Shah leave.
And remind us why. The Shah was supported by the United States. He was very much in favor with many people. He built roads. He built railroads as well. Many systems that brought people in from rural areas, but there were still major problems.
Exactly. There was no political freedom. And the country had a huge population that had become educated. A lot of people had become interested in leftist ideas. They'd become communists. And there was a huge population that thought if the Shah left, they could have political freedom. And so before the revolution, there were a lot of my parents' friends who were leftists or were simply opposed to the Shah, and they wanted him to leave power. But I think the biggest mistake that they made was that all they knew was that they wanted the Shah to go. They didn't know what they wanted after the revolution and what happened after the Shah left. When there was institutional breakdown, when there was chaos, Khomeini easily hijacked the revolution. And none of these people were religious. None of them supported Khomeini's kind of regime. So very soon, they were all disillusioned in the revolution, in the aftermaths of what happened. And they lost their faith.
There were, many Americans still remember very vividly in the 1979 revolution, the capture of American hostages being blindfolded and led through the streets by young Iranians who supported the revolution. Do you have any memory of that yourself?
I do. It was one of the many horrifying incidents that were happening inside the country. I still remember the footage on TV. Of course, the footage that I was seeing was from a totally different perspective. It was supportive of what had happened. I remember the Islamist students who were constantly shown on TV with the hostages. My parents were terrified. They were terrified of the consequences of what had happened. But at the same time, there were so many other things happening. People were being constantly rounded up. Many children of our family members, of friends, they'd become slightly interested in leftist ideas. They'd been arrested. They were in prison. We were constantly getting news of their executions. So for Iranians, that was one of many horrible things that was happening inside the country.
And there is a time that you write in your book, you were in second grade, and the state-run newspaper ran a front-page photo showing corpses. These were the bodies of the Shah's generals who were deemed to be corrupt on earth by a judge. What was it like for you during this time, Nazila, to be surrounded by violence as a young girl, and how did your parents explain it to you?
It was very hard for them to explain what was happening. In the beginning, they used to hide it from us. My mother tried to sort of nab the paper before I could get it. It was always dropped in our mailbox, and it was my job to pick it up. But then my mother tried to pick it up before I did, because the front page was constantly filled with pictures of corpses. But we constantly heard grown-ups talk about it, and gradually they were not so cautious to hide it from us, especially because we were hearing about friends' executions, about people we knew.
You know, it's funny because you hear all this, and you looking at what you saw, what you read in the state-run newspaper, and then against probability, you decide to become a journalist, and a journalist first as a translator, but then a journalist for the New York Times. That was very risky. How did you carry out your job when what you were doing was against what the revolution and revolutionaries wanted you to do?
Well, there's a very fine line in Iran, and as long as you know how to maneuver around that fine line, you can do almost anything.
Like, what did you do?
That's one thing that I learned after the revolution. I mean, even as I was growing up, I learned how I could violate all the restrictions at school, in society, and try to be who I was. It became a game. And people of my generation, all are like that. It was a constant struggle to be sort of in control of our minds and our bodies. So when, by the time the war had ended in the early 1990s, and I became interested in journalism, I had become quite an expert at maneuvering around this fine line. So I learned very quickly that if I wanted to be a journalist, I could be one, but I have to respect some of the red lines, or if I was going to touch those red lines, I had to rely on government sources, news sources that was released by the government. So it's a constant game in Iran. It's not a place where you can't do anything, or you would be fearful to do certain work.
There is a point where you realized you couldn't do this work anymore, and it's kind of terrifying the way you find out. You describe a point where you're being followed, and you're in your car. You're going to see a political analyst. You can't get there because you notice first when you come out of the apartment, there's somebody in the car. That person follows you. You lose them. Somebody else follows you. Then two men on motorcycles come up to your left and your right, and you try to lose them. Eventually, you make it home. At what point did you decide you really had to leave because you felt threatened by the government, and how did you leave?
It was in 2009, after the uprising, some of the largest ever in the country since the revolution. Reporters inside the country were ordered not to cover the protests, but, I mean, they were the biggest stories I had covered. I had waited for many years to cover a story like that, so I kept going out. I received calls, warnings to stop going out. I ignored them. And then about 2.5 weeks after the uprising, one day I left my home and I noticed a team of people were following me. And it was then that I decided it was time to leave the country. Fortunately, I had tickets I had bought many months earlier, and we used those tickets to leave the country. But I never thought that this is it, that I would leave the country and I wouldn't be able to return. Somehow, I thought that this would end as well, and I would return and do what I was doing. But it turned out it was a totally different a juncture in the history of Iran.
Because you haven't gone back.
I haven't gone back, and a lot of things have changed in Iran since then.
When you came to the United States, obviously you were an adult. The United States had been an enemy of the revolution. As we said, Americans were taken hostage during the revolution. I wonder if you felt it necessary, just as when you were a young girl in Iran, to say, we support, yes, of course, we support the revolution, even though you didn't. When you came to the United States, Did you feel that it was incumbent on you to make it clear to Americans that you didn't support the revolution, just in case? I mean, was there a certain kind of pressure of any kind that you felt, either self-imposed or imposed from the outside?
Well, you know, we learned from a very early age in Iran that you have a public life and you have a private life. We separated the two spaces. We just lied in that public space where we had to. And once I was, like, in a private space or even at a school with ordinary Iranians, even people who supported the revolution, I didn't lie. Iranians are quite outspoken about their sentiments toward the regime. They publicly denounce the regime. Cab drivers constantly complain about how life has changed after the revolution. So I never felt that I had to lie to my friends inside the country.
How about here? Was anything different here in terms of what you could say? Or was did you find that Americans wanted to put you in a certain box as one of those kind of quote-unquote good Iranians?
No. There are a lot of cliches and stereotypes about Iran, but I don't know. That never happened to me. I never had to explain my politics or my preferences. It was as if, like, Iranians always feel that they are members of a global culture. I don't know if it's that attitude that makes us feel comfortable. And we, even if there are those kinds of questions in people's minds, I never heard them.
There was when you came to the United States and had a fellowship in Boston. You engaged in a lot of academic lectures. You were on panels. There was a lot of political discourse at the time about whether the U.S. would possibly go to war with Iran. There was an event that you went to, because I remember seeing you there, and there were some people who were talking. You were part of this circle, but they didn't know that you were Iranian. And they were talking about what would happen if the United States dropped a nuclear bomb on Tehran. I remember seeing you as you turned away from the conversation. You looked almost ashen. What was going on in your mind then?
Well, you know, I grew up during a war. I know what war's devastation means. I know what kind of destruction it brings. And even if you have not lived through a war, everybody has seen movies about them. Who wants their home to be bombed? I mean,
and this was discussion of possibly a nuclear bomb.
Exactly. It was. I was shocked. I was appalled. I couldn't imagine people would talk about a country that way.
In terms of the numbers of people who might be killed.
Yeah.
You have family still there?
I have family there. I have friends. A lot of people I went to school with.
And do you think you'll be able to go back?
I'm sure I will go back.
We hope that comes to pass. Nazila Fati, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa.
Nazila Fati is the author of The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. She's going to be speaking about the book tonight at the Harvard Bookstore. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins with Anthony Brooks. Stay with us.